Hello, Bulldogs. Thank you for tuning in to Who's Behind the Bulldog, Arvada High School's community interview podcast series. I'm your host and one of the assistant principals at Arvada, Jeremy Jensen. Each week, I'll sit down with someone from our Arvada community, be it staff, students, families, or other community members, to hear their stories. We'll discuss their histories, successes, challenges, learnings, future hopes and dreams, and much more. I hope you find some connections in their stories and hopefully are inspired to take some time to get to know them a bit better as our school year progresses. We have an amazing community here at Arvada, and I hope we can continue to strengthen that despite the challenges that await us in these unknown times.
Today's guest is special education teacher and department chair, Matt Katzman. In this episode, Matt discusses how his Toyota Highlander represents his dynamic personality. He talks about the need to be flexible and adaptable, how he's proud of many of the projects he's been able to co-plan with various teachers, and about some of the strategies he uses to individualize education for his students. Thanks for tuning into today's episode with Matt Katzman.
Matt Katzman, thanks for joining me today for Who's Behind the Bulldog.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is pleasant.
Matt, tell everyone a little bit about yourself and what brought you into education.
I moved to Arvada 3 years ago from Kansas City, Missouri, where I had done the Teacher America program. And then I taught elementary school for 4 years in Kansas City. And before that, I was in St. Louis for a little bit, substitute teaching. And that was after I spent a year teaching English as a second language in South Korea. So the journey with education really started with going to South Korea as an English teacher, wrapping up college. I was like, what the heck am I gonna do? Wisconsin had a great program that sent students to a specific program in and a specific province in South Korea, which was the Gyeonggi province, and it was south of Seoul. So it was kind of like Seoul suburbs and metropolitan area. And so I taught elementary school, fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And then I also had a kindergarten class there just teaching English. And so that's really where I got the education bug and decided that was what I wanted to, pursue as a career. So I kind of took the non-traditional route. After I got home from Korea, I spent a couple months substitute teaching and trying to figure out, which program is right? Where am I going to go get my certificate? How am I going to go do this? And, I applied for the Teacher America program because I really aligned with the mission there. And I was lucky enough to be accepted, and I started teaching in Kansas City, Missouri at the beginning of 2014. And I was never originally supposed to be a special education teacher. I was supposed to be a middle school science teacher, but I was applying for plenty of jobs, and I was like, I'll take the special ed praxis, and maybe it'll open up some doors. And I got a job as a special education teacher at the elementary level, and I fell in love with the profession, being able to support students who really need it the most, the kids that are just the most overlooked and always, at least at the elementary level, that's really what it was these kids that just, were super overlooked and needed a lot of extra love and attention. And I haven't looked back since then. So, it was a transition going from a resource room in an elementary school to a full co-taught model at a high school. But I've really enjoyed the shift. I really enjoy digging in with the content as well as the special education side. So, I'm really, really enjoying that transition.
What was life like for you in Seoul?
I loved it. I was like a pig in poop. It was, you know, the teaching, pretty standard hours, but I wasn't doing a ton of necessarily planning or grading or anything like that. So, you know, I would teach normal hours, and then I would have weekends and vacations to go out and explore. And I was just able to go, you know, all around Korea. And then I started traveling in Asia a little bit. And it was really spectacular. I loved, the students were just so caring and so friendly and so open. And, you know, every day just kept me on my toes. And I definitely stood out like a sore thumb, but I don't think I would have it any other way. I was pretty much the only foreigner in my little teeny town. And I just, you know, I could eat Korean food for days. And so it suited me well. And, you know, it was a non-traditional entry into the teaching world. But, you know, a lot of the stuff still aligns with what we do here. Obviously, teaching English as a second language is very different from teaching special education or any, you know, co-teaching any content area. But it really gave me a chance to kind of understand some instructional strategies and really have to get creative with the things that I was doing in the classroom because there was this, you know, massive language barrier with a lot of my co-teachers and a lot of my students. So I had to get really creative with, you know, activities and hands-on stuff. So I really enjoyed it.
Have any of those creative strategies that you used over there sort of translated well for you in the special ed world here at Arvada?
Implementing the visual stuff and the kind of hands-on stuff and games and getting really creative with that translated a little bit, but I really had to break it down and do a lot of hands-on activities and immersion type things that haven't necessarily translated to content areas quite as much, but definitely the ideas behind some of the strategies have carried over.
What are some of the things that you've done at Arvada that you have been the most proud of?
I think that, you know, just helping to develop some of these PBLs over the past couple of years, especially the Shout PBL with Mathis, and really being a part of that Geo Studies PBL last year, especially the one with the, you know, the one last year we did with climate change and the UN summit was really cool. I think being able to be in the planning of those PBLs is really an awesome part of co-planning. And those are some of the things that I'm really proud of. And then also just, you know, I pat myself on the back for picking up a very different system in high school than I was learning in elementary. So, you know, I'm obviously still learning a ton, but just being able to learn all that and put it into practice and now being able to teach that to other people and be kind of a source of leadership there has been nice.
Say more about that between your experience in high school as a student and versus as a teacher.
I don't know how to answer that. Obviously, the project-based learning turns everything on its head. I mean, in high school, I was very used to reading chapters out of a textbook, taking a quiz, reading another chapter, taking a quiz, and then having a final exam, just a very thing like that. And there weren't a ton of chances to break the mold with that. I did, in middle school, I had this really awesome, amazing teacher who really built on field experiences and did a ton of hands-on stuff. And I think that's where I pull a lot of inspiration in terms of planning and thinking outside of the box was Miss Sermos. She actually had the pleasure of having me in sixth grade and eighth grade. I'm not quite sure how she got through it, but you know, we were in field trips every single week and doing these really fun hands-on things, and just seeing, having that experience as a student and seeing it almost as abnormal makes me want to make that the norm.
You mentioned that was an inspiration for you. So what are some of the specific things that that's led to for you?
Just connecting things outside of specific curricular aspects. So like she had a saying that, you know, everything in the universe is connected somehow. She really believed in, you know, what she thought of as the butterfly effect, that everything impacts everything else and it's all connected in kind of this massive web. And so anything that we did in history class or in the history content was connected with what she was doing with the science content. And so I think that's so important. So even as we like to see our content kind of departmentalized and individualized, like, it is important to remember that it's all connected in a way that anything you are going to use in English class is also going to be of use in science class. And anything that you're learning in science class might come back up again in your geometry class. So just really hammering home that connectedness and how cross-curricular we can be. And I think that's one thing that, you know, the Arvada model with our integrated classes that we're using is really spectacular for that, because there's just, you know, it shouldn't be an individual English class and an individual history class. It should be connected because it's intricately connected, and we shouldn't think of it any other way.
Truer words have never been spoken on this podcast, Mr. Katzman. Wow. Thinking about your SPED students, what are some of your favorite go-to strategies to get those students engaged and to get them the access to the materials that they need?
I think one thing is just that students in general, but especially SPED students, are just, you know, they're in their 10th or 11th grade year of school, and they may have been struggling with some, you know, a specific content or a specific subject for, you know, 5, 8, 10 years. And when they see a subject, it pulls up this blind spot for them, and it shuts them down sometimes, or they just have this feeling that, you know, this isn't for me, I'm not going to do well. And so I think, even before we approach instructional strategies, just really trying to build relationships with students and learn about their life and what they're doing outside of school just goes such a long way, because you start off that conversation with, hey, how's your sister? Or, you know, I know you and your dad were going to go camping. Did you guys go camping? What was it like? Just to really start off the conversation on a positive note and build that relationship slowly but surely, to start hammering away at that content. But you know, I really think that being able to offer material in a variety of ways is kind of a backbone of any good pedagogy. You know, finding, if kids are reading an article, trying to find a video that relates to it, or trying to find a podcast, or having some sort of visuals that back it up so that our students that learn in different ways are able to access that content without feeling like they can't do it. So those are, you know, those are a couple of approaches I have. I also think giving student a lot of choice and a lot of direction in what they're going to do, and really letting them take the reins on talking through stuff. A lot of times kids will instantly look to you for, oh, is that the right answer? Did I say the right thing? And I just am constantly encouraging students, you know, say more about that. What do you mean by that? And that eventually leads them into that line of thinking that, you know, you were on the right track, you got there. And so I think just really basing the teaching on relationships and using that as a cornerstone and a foundation is so important, because it all starts there.
But also, like, like what you said at the end too, just about like figuring out what is their thinking, right? Like what, why are they in the space that they're currently in? That'll help you to make the next move to help them to like advance and to like to learn from that.
And I also like on that, it's a process, right? You're not going to have a student in class for 2 days and be like, oh, I know exactly how to reach this student. I know how to teach this kid. Like, it's a process. I'm thinking of a specific student who we've had since freshman year, and, you know, slowly but surely, freshman year, he told me he was going to, that he wanted to fight me, right? And today, you know, we have a great relationship. And so it's just about chipping away and slowly but surely making progress with kids and building that relationship. Because the more trusting you are, and the more they realize that, hey, this guy's not holding grudges, or this guy's not out to get me, the better that relationship becomes, and the easier you can facilitate learning, and it doesn't turn into a battle.
So how is this related to equity from your perspective? You know, that's a big focus, obviously, that we have at the school, to think about all learners, and that absolutely includes our special ed students. So how do you promote the most equitable education possible?
I mean, I think it kind of, it harkens back to that conversation where it's like chipping away and slowly learning what kids need is one of those first steps to doing that. Obviously, equity is just embedded in SPED as it is. And I think recognizing each student as an individual with very unique needs, rather than an 11th grade English student or, you know, a 10th grade geometry student, recognizing them as an individual and what those specific needs are in order to provide that equity, is kind of that first step. And then just being pragmatic about it, right? If you perceive something as being equitable, but it's not working out and it's not achieving those results, then you have to be pragmatic and change that approach. And so recognizing that equity is kind of a process, and it's not something that we're going to know right away what's equitable and what's not. But really basing it on what we figure out about kids and how we learn about kids and what we come to know about kids, and not seeing it as here's equity, but it's a very nuanced, especially down to the individual students' needs and specific subjects to make it equitable. So, you know, we as case managers spend a lot of time thinking through specific accommodations for kids and specific goals for students. And, you know, so equity is embedded in that. And so I think about equity through a lot of lenses, but specifically as a SPED teacher, just really thinking about it through students' learning needs. That's where I see equity playing out for a lot of our students, at least from my perspective. Obviously there's other perspectives on equity, but as I think of it through a special education teacher's lens, really thinking about it as specific to a student's learning needs, and something that's evolving and something that's changing and not set in stone.
Speaking of evolving and not set in stone, we're in the middle of a pandemic right now. So how are you making that work for our students' needs currently?
You had to ask that, didn't you? I have seen that equity piece, especially from the SPED perspective, is lost sometimes with the virtual learning. And so I've been trying to bring small groups of students into the building, because that's where the equity is for them, is that they need to be in-person learning and in front of a teacher to be able to access that content. And so, you know, working on that, also trying to embed strategies that pull out students' interests and personality in Zoom calls. You know, just dumb questions like, you know, if you're on the assignment and you've made a copy, type your favorite movie into the chat, right? And So having just silly stuff like that to kind of pull out students' personality and give it some a little bit of life has helped. I have been preaching about the Echo accommodations tool or the Echo differentiation tool. So using that and then also really implementing breakout rooms and taking advantage of the fact that, you know, students may want to or feel like they fly under the radar in a large group, but then once they're in a breakout room to really connect with the students and try to provide that instruction as much as I can on an individualized basis is super helpful. But man, if we had good answers for this, it'd be a different ball game. But you know, it's like I said, it's just about learning what works with specific kids or specific group of kids. Like even as much as saying like, you know, this kid doesn't check their email, but they'll check their GChat. So that's how I know I need to get in touch with the student and not assuming that every single student's going to answer their emails. And so I'm going to send an email. And if a kid doesn't respond to that email, then, you know, whatever it may be, but saying, okay, what's the most appropriate way to contact this kid? How will they respond? And then adjust the learning to fit that.
It is not an easy situation this year, for sure. Now that we've got one semester under our belts for 2020-2021 school year, what are you most looking forward to for semester two?
Honestly, even though I think the remote learning has been really tough for our kids, especially students on IEPs, I'm looking forward to kind of figuring out how to make it work a little bit better for them. I get really jazzed about learning new things and figuring out new things. And so I think, you know, as much as we would all like to be back in person teaching, like the pandemic never happened, I think it is kind of great to build this tool set and continue to figure out ways to really effectively reach and teach students. But man, it's hard. So I guess I'm looking forward to kind of continuing to figure out how to individualize education through a screen or through a computer. And then I'm also looking forward to seeing how some of these PBLs continue to pan out and seeing how creative students can get with, you know, with some of their stuff. We have a 12th grader who wrote, you know, they're doing an awareness campaign for the mask debate. And he, you know, we gave him a menu of options for things to do for the PBL. And he said, no, I'm going to do a two-person radio show, radio comedy. And so it's really cool that to see what students can do to when you let them get creative and do what aligns with their interests. So I'm excited to see how that continues to play out through some of the projects.
I have hopes that second semester will have figured some extra things out and people will continue on this like giant learning curve this year. But I feel like we're so much further along than we were once upon a time. So thanks for everything you've been doing to support that.
Yeah, I would agree. And honestly, as I actually think Echo is a really fantastic platform. I'm going to accommodate or grade this kid on based on, you know, I want them to verbally present this project rather than type it out or do some, you know, so even adjusting what we're grading on in the rubric is a really cool way to differentiate.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for leading that session. And listeners, if you haven't checked that out, that's available in Echo. It's available in the Bulldog blogs. So Matt has led a session with differentiating for Echo use, and it's awesome. So please check that out if you haven't done so on video.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to check it out. It's a really cool tool and it's fun to play around with. And I don't think I've said this a billion times in those things, but it's definitely not just for differentiation along the lines of accommodations. There's a lot of ways to get really creative with it in terms of group work and jigsawing and anything like that. So I think I'm also excited to see how teachers continue to use that tool and explore that tool.
Matt, what would you consider to be your best failure?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's like obviously not an abject failure, but you know, when I was in college, I was like, man, we just paid all this money for a college degree and I'm sitting here and I have no idea what I want to do with my life. And so at the time it seemed kind of like a plan E to go get on a plane and go to Korea and go teach. But I would say that was probably the best plan E that I've ever encountered, because it eventually led me here to this career that, you know, I love and I feel a lot of passion for and I get really wrapped up in. And so while it wasn't a failure on the surface, it felt like a little bit of a failure to me to like not have an amazing like job offer waiting for me when I graduated college, when all my friends were getting, I'm moving to Chicago to work for whatever stupid company. And I'm sitting there my senior year, just twiddling my thumbs like, oh man, should I be doing all this? So at the time it felt like kind of a failure and like I was behind the curve, but it put me on this path towards what I do now. And I don't think I would have it any other way.
So what big advice do you have for other educators?
I got tons of big advice. I'm full of big advice. I would say the one thing that I found is that being patient and flexible and adaptable has really made my life a lot easier in the teaching profession. And, you know, I think there are battles to be picked, but they have to be picked wisely, and trying to die on every single hill that you walk on is a recipe for failure. So really focusing on those issues that, yeah, I'm going to stick by it. I'm going to stick by my guns on this one. I'm not backing down, and saying, okay, you know what? I can cast aside my ego here and move forward for the good of the students, it makes people willing to kind of approach you, and makes it workable. And then also like send some of that cosmic karma into the future where, you know, you go to ask one of those teachers or one of those colleagues for something down the road. And they, you know, it facilitates relationships that are very constructive.
Matt, it's been great chatting with you today. Thank you so much for all of your flexibility and adaptability and really push towards, everything that's student-centered and making sure that all of our students, especially our SPED students, are getting the education that they deserve. So thanks for all of the work that you have been doing with the SPED team and for the school. You're very, very valued at our school.
Well, I appreciate that. I would thank you for having me on here. I do recognize that you forgot to mention my very dynamic personality. So I don't know if you can edit it out and say flexibility, adaptability, and dynamic personability or personality. But yeah, or just put subtitles or whatever, however you do it.
What kind of car do you drive again?
Toyota Highlander, but it's a sport edition. So it's kind of sporty and a little bit more dynamic.
Yes, absolutely. That car will match your personality. So the dynamic components of your Highlander are definitely representative of who you are. And I apologize for neglecting to mention your dynamic personality earlier.
Thank you. Yes, it's a very dynamic part of my personality. Yeah. So thanks for having me. It's always fun to kind of probe and start thinking about that, especially as it's a reflective exercise on semester one. But then it's also kind of probing and thinking about semester two and how we continue to improve our craft. And so I think it's kind of cool to be the last one in semester one to have this honor, because it's a useful reflection exercise.
Awesome. Thanks again, Matt.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you all for tuning into today's podcast. I want to encourage you to take a minute to reach out to today's guest and make a personal connection. Until next time, this has been Jeremy Jensen with Who's Behind the Bulldog.